speak tonight. We're here le'ilu nishmat our dear father and Saba, Yishai Teller, Zichron Vracha, a Kohen. I know many people in the community know and remember my father. He was here a number of years. My father always liked going to the shiurim. He didn't like the heavy Gemara stuff and things like that. He really liked the Mishnayot, the Rambam, and Parshat Shavua shiurim, and he liked Pshat. I've never had the schut of knowing Rabbi Kahn personally, but I'm a big fan of his and listen on the podcasts. And a lot of times I notice he's constantly going back to Pshat. So I thought it would be a nice way to remember Abba that Rabbi Kahn will give a shiur on Parshat Shavua.
If I'm not mistaken, what we agreed upon was not just the Parsha, the whole book.
The book.
The whole book. Okay. And how much time do we have for that?
2-3 hours.
Normally when we study Chumash, we actually... Okay. If that was a hint, so then... But from what I understand, he did not do this to Seinfeld last week. Okay. When we study, what we tend to do is we either take a whole parsha, and when we do that, we have, I think we can call it tunnel vision. We just look at the parsha. We don't look before. We don't look after. We just start wherever it happens to start. Or sometimes when we study, and now it goes back to perhaps when we were younger, we were studying in yeshiva, we looked at words, and we looked at psukim, and we looked at commentaries. But what we never do is what I want to do today, and that is look at it as a book. Sefer Bereishit happens to be a book. We finished this book today. So what we decided to do was to try to have some type of, I think what we called it, a retrospective of what this book is about. So just now starting all over again. Okay, so what is the book of Bereishit about? It's an interesting book. It's not a happy book. I've read happy books. By the way, those of you who have not gotten to the end, I'm sorry. I may ruin it for you today, but they all die and they're stuck in Egypt. Okay, that's it. I ruined it for you. So Rashi has a very interesting comment in the very, very beginning. Rashi talks about Bereshit, and he talks about God creating, and right away Rashi goes into a Zionist approach. That God created the land, and God can take away the land, and God gave it to us, and people say that we stole it, we should quote a pasuk from them. I mean, by the way, you realize that's quite amusing, that if anybody accuses us of stealing, we should just tell them, no, it says in Rashi that it's really, that's really ours. Well, if you look at the pasuk that Rashi, and I'm not going to go into that, but you look at the pasuk that Rashi quotes, you realize that Rashi is not telling us to tell anyone else, he's telling us to tell ourselves, that we need to remember exactly who this land belongs to. But what Rashi accomplishes by this is, in a sense, he sets the stage that this is what the book is about, and the book is about the land. Now, that's something which I don't think any of us would have said, like, right away, what is Bereishit about? It's about the land. Doesn't seem to be about the land. The land doesn't seem to jump up at us in terms of being the major issue. So that's the first thing that I want to say, is that Rashi therefore gave us a hint. What Sefer Bereishit is about is indeed about the land. Now, how can I justify that? Well, one thing I can do is I can take a look and see how many times God speaks in all of Sefer Bereishit. No, this is the question that all of you should now be asking yourselves. How many times does God speak in Sefer Bereishit? And when he does speak, what does he tend to speak about? So I can go through all the conversations, especially the conversations once Avraham is introduced, and all the conversations between Avraham, and then with Yitzchak, and then with Yaakov, and say, now what is the major topic when God does speak? So what's the answer to that? It's about the land. The major issue in terms of God relating to man is about the land of Israel, is about having a covenant, is about having children. But it always keeps coming back to the land. So therefore, right away, I now realize that that comment that Rashi made, which seemed to us perhaps to have been, you know, somewhat off focus, again, unnecessary Zionism, no, that's really what this book is indeed about. Second point, what the book is about. Bereishit is a book about brothers. Right? Going all the way through from the beginning to the end, it's a book about brothers. The corollary to that, Bereishit is a book about brothers that don't get along. Third corollary to that, it's a book about brothers that don't get along, then inevitably the younger brother is the one who's successful. By the way, my older brother did not agree with this last point. But it's correct anyway. It's correct. I mean, that is what the entire book is about. From beginning to end, it's a book about brothers who don't get along. When we start Sefer Shemot, and especially Chazal, when we get, I guess, closer to the Makat Bechorot, Chazal is going to be insisting to us that this meeting between Moshe and Paro is a fascinating meeting, because Paro is a firstborn, and what Chazal tell us, I believe that's Pshat, but not only is he firstborn, Chazal insists that he is the firstborn of the firstborn of the firstborn of the firstborn. Rav Soloveitchik, when he spoke about this, he made up a word, he called it primogeniture. I don't know if anyone else ever used that word, but he says that's what Egyptian society is based upon. Where, and by the way, the visual for this is a pyramid, with Paro standing, or sitting, as it were, on top of the entire pyramid, being the firstborn for many, many, many generations, and therefore he has his face. And then he meets up with Moshe, who's not a firstborn, who comes from Amram, who I believe is not, coming from Levi, who is not, and coming from Yaakov, who is not, and going from, and you keep on going back and realize that the meeting over here is a very interesting meeting. And therefore, if we deal in a society where success is based upon power, power very often is connected to the place of birth, and Sefer Bereishit, therefore, we see a rebellion taking place against something which had normally been conceived as being deserving of power simply because of where you were born, which of course is not really deserving, but therefore it's an accident of birth, versus something which we could perhaps call more of a meritocracy, whereby Avraham is chosen, and by the way, and we're never told why, Avraham is chosen, but what we seem to, actually we are told why at one point, because of his ability to follow what God wants, because of his ability in order to really choose and to do the right thing. So far, what do we have the book being about? So far, the book is about land, and the book is about brothers who don't necessarily get along. Going through all of Sefer Bereishit, another thing, how often does God get involved? Again, I mean, normally you think about biblical things, God gets involved, and God does all kinds of... How often does God get involved in Sefer Bereishit? How often does he come, and does God punish? Who are the people who are inevitably punished? Again, all of these questions are questions which I can only ask when we look at it as an entire book, instead of looking at, again, one little section, one little parsha, because when we look at it as a parsha, we don't see the larger themes which take place. So I gave you a lot of time to think just now. So who are going to be the ones that God ends up punishing throughout the book? Let's say, again, at least in Bereishit, who are the ones who get punished? Don't, you can't answer. Stop. They'll think I set it up. Stop. They'll think, actually, you know what they really think? They'll think that I torture you. They'll think at night, like I make you, like, make you study and so on. Yeah, so who is, who, because, again, go back to the point. Do we realize, I want to go back to this point about God getting involved. If we were to edit it, we would get God involved much more than God is involved in Bereishit. Right? Is God overly involved, or is God really in the background in Bereishit? Okay, so when does God get involved? So then we have cataclysms. Yes? I mean, if you really want to be fancy, you can call cataclysms of biblical proportions, because it is the Bible, so therefore it's we have... So where does God get involved? So, okay, of course, obviously, the first thing we're going to say is the... Let's start with the flood, right? We like the flood. Oh. Good. So we can actually go a little bit before, and we have. Good. Excellent. Cataclysms. We want big involvement. Okay. So let me try again in order to help you all. There's a lot of bad behavior in Bereishit. Yes? Yes? There's a lot of bad behavior. So now, I realized before that it wasn't that you gave the wrong answer, it was that I asked the wrong question. So now I'm going to try to make my question match your answer, so therefore you can all feel much better. So there's bad behavior in Bereishit. Who is guilty of this bad behavior? So now you can go back and say, well, we can start with Who should we start with? First bad behavior in Bereshit is? No, no, and no. Who? No, no. The serpent. The serpent. No. The son of the moon. No, it's not in Chumash. No, it's not in Chumash either. The first bad behavior in Bereshit is the Nachash. The Nachash didn't behave. The Nachash didn't behave. The Nachash behaved. The Nachash behaved poorly. Yeah, one second. Can we agree on that point?
We agree on that.
Okay, that's all. The Nachash behaved poorly. In the Chumash?
Yes.
Yeah. I know, no, you see, you're, okay, stop, it's very good what you're saying, but you're just confused between the Chumash says and what the Midrashim say. I like the Midrashim as well. Now, did the Chumash say the land did something wrong? Why are you picking on the land? It was very nice land. Right, so I'm saying in Pshat there's nothing wrong there. It's only like rabbis like me who have too much time on their hands, and then we say, oh, even the land sinned, and so on and so forth. I'm sorry. I'll ask the question again. Just give you a better chance. The first one who misbehaves in the Torah, is the Nachash. What the Nachash does is not very nice. What did the Nachash do? What was the terrible sin of the Nachash? So now you can say, hold it, sin maybe is the wrong word. Of course, when you do sin, you have to break something. God didn't say anything and so forth. So I'm with you. I didn't ask you that. I said, who's the one who doesn't behave nicely? So the answer is the Nachash. The Nachash goes and instigates, right? The Nachash goes and instigates and gets Eve, and then by extension Adam, to go against God's instruction. And by the way, it was all very simple back then. God did not give us all that many commandments. I mean, you do realize, of course, that the Sforno says what I'm about to say now. It's a very scary Sforno. You won't believe me if I tell you what he says. He says it all the way later on in Vayikra. I'm just trying to think, does he say it in Shmini a little before that? Shmini or Tezriah. It's either by Shmini or by Tezriah. He says that had there not been a Chet Ha'egel, we would have no laws of Nida at all, and kosher. I know you can't believe me that he actually said such a thing. But Chet Ha'egel. Chet Ha'egel. He says it. He really says it. But it's not an isolated statement. Every time there's sin, he claims that we need more mitzvot. That when we don't have holiness in our lives by listening and obeying what God told us, so the result is having more. By the way, that's why there's so many chumrot today. I'm not kidding. That if you look at the Sforno, understand what he's saying, is that a lack of real spirituality gets replaced by more and more laws in order to make not real spirituality because we seem to need it. So he says this in multiple places in the Chumash. All you need to do if you want to find them is start learning through the Sforno, okay? Here comes the sales pitch. I'm sorry and I apologize. I believe that in my book of Vayikra, I did make a footnote about this and I pointed at all the places that he does this. But he does do this in multiple places. In the Garden of Eden, we only really have not so many mitzvot. Lovdo l'shomra. Right, Lo Avdol L'Shomra does not sound all that complicated. Right, what happens subsequently? We end up getting more and more mitzvot as we move on. Every time we mess up, we end up getting more and more mitzvot. Okay, so let's try again. The Nachash doesn't behave very properly. If you like Midrashim, I can tell you crazy Midrashim. Crazy Midrashim. For example, there are multiple sources that claim, and I'm not going to talk about this now, but there are multiple sources that claim that Cain and Hevel had two different fathers. Yeah. So you're saying, hold it, who was around, right? Adam and Bill, right? No, it's that. Then, yeah, it says, look. I know that our problem with the Nachash is, but the Nachash is a Nachash. No, the Nachash becomes a Nachash. How does a Nachash become a Nachash? Because after the sin, it loses its legs. It ends up, right now, you're going to slither around the ground. So beforehand, actually, it stood like a man. That's really what Chazal say. It stood like a man, and it talked like a man. So now you all know what I'm going to say. If it talks like a man and it walks like a man, so it's a duck. Okay. But there are midrashic sources that say that Cain and Hevel had two different fathers, and that was really the basis of the problem between them. And therefore, you have... Okay, we'll go with one more midrash. You have two verses, one after the other, which are quite similar. One talks about Adam and Eve being naked. What word does it use for naked? And the next verse says that the Nachash was more naked than anyone. Or does it not say that it was more naked? What did it say? So it uses the exact same word, two verses, but again, they're two different chapters. And all of us are dedicated students to the Archbishop of Canterbury, and therefore if it's a different, right, you know that, yes or no? The one who made up the chapters is indeed the Archbishop of Canterbury, and therefore it's of a different perek, so that we don't look at it being connected whatsoever, but you have one verse after the other of Adam and Eve were naked and frolicking about the Garden of Eden, which is why I guess they call it the Garden of Eden. And then you had, the very next verse, you have the Nachash, and the Nachash is Arum. Now, Arum, we all know, doesn't really mean naked. It's like, although the snake could be considered something naked because the snake even loses its skin, so even for the skin that it has, it ends up losing, so therefore it can be more naked than anything. But the Nachash is not a Nachash yet, which is, of course, our problem. And the Nachash is talking to Eve and telling Eve, you know, God didn't mean this. And by the way, the Nachash never lies. If you pay attention carefully, the Nachash never lied all the way through. She said, we're going to die. You're not going to die. So guess who was right? They didn't die. God said, you right? She said, we can't eat it or touch it. No, God didn't say that. So all the way through, the Nachash is actually telling the truth, but that's the worst kind. Keeps telling the truth, and the truth is trying to get us. Now, does anybody remember what Rashi said in that last verse or so in chapter, in Perek Bet? Remember what Rashi says? The Nachash spies upon Adam and Eve, and he's jealous. So you see, it's interesting. Okay, let's try. Probably should even look in Chumash or something. The Nachash, yeah, please. The Nachash says, you cannot eat from every single tree of the field. Is that true or not? Shall I try that again? The Nachash says, okay, try it again. V'yushneim arumim ha'adam v'yishto v'lo yitboshishu. V'nachash sheya arumi kol chayat ha'sadeh asher asa Hashem Elokim. V'yomer ele isha, af ki amar Elokim lo tochlu mikol eitz hagan. God said you cannot eat from every tree of the field. Is that true or is it not true? What did God actually say? You can eat from every tree of the field except for the tree of knowledge of good and evil. What about the tree of life? What did God say? God didn't say anything. So if Adam was Jewish, then what would he have done? He would have eaten from the tree of life, then had from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and would have left. Yes? And if you ever play, what is it, Monopoly? You get out of jail card first, and then you do something criminal? I mean, there are many Jews who do this. So now your time to think again. Did the Nachash lie, or did the Nachash tell the truth? Shall I read it again? Any lawyers here? Don't worry. Okay. Don't worry. We won't ask lawyers for free services. We know better than that. The Hanachash Sheya Aru Mikol Chayat HaSadeh Asher Asa Hashem Elokim VaYomer Ela Isha Af Ki Amar Elokim Lo Tochlu Mikol Eitz Hagan. You cannot eat from every tree of the field. Truth or not truth? True or not true?
True.
True. You cannot eat from every tree of the field. Why can't you eat from every tree of the field? Because there's one you can't eat of. If there's one you can't eat of, you can't eat from every tree of the field. Misleading? Very lawyer-like? Sorry. Misleading? Is this like in the small print? But it's true. By the way, now realize that the Nachash could have had any woman that it wanted except for one, because she is the soulmate of Adam. So there is a parallel over here. Excuse me?
She's also the only woman.
Oh, you'd be surprised. No, but my point is that's exactly what Chazal is saying, is that the Nachash has jealousy, and the Nachash has lust, and the Nachash therefore tries to communicate this lust to the woman, which is exactly why it goes on to say that suddenly lust becomes part of the conversation, that she develops lust towards this tree. But I want to stop a second, and I want to hold on to this very, very strange teaching that therefore says that the Nachash, right, you've ever heard this, or this sounds completely crazy, and I'm sorry, I will come back to Pshat, that the Nachash does end up succeeding seducing Eve, and the Nachash gets her pregnant. By the way, Adam also gets her pregnant. I don't know if it's at the same time, and I don't know if Cain and Heva were twins or not. Any doctors over here? Now they're afraid. No doctors. Is it possible to be pregnant from two different men at once? What do you mean by technically? This is a yes or a no. I mean, either you're pregnant or you're not. This is not a technically. Okay. Yes. Yes. So, is it possibly pregnant by two people at once? Yeah, it is. And what do you need to do? You need to sleep with them both within a certain time frame. That's a suggestion which actually comes out. So, therefore, you have these two different people. You have Cain and Hevel. So now I want to move on from Cain and Hevel and just plant that in your heads. And what happens when they get kicked out of the Garden of Eden? Okay. First of all, they get kicked out of Holy Land. Okay. Pay attention. Land is the issue. We're not paying attention to the land. They get kicked out of Holy Land. Then what happens? They have to work. Okay, so we have Cain and Hevel, right? Leave Adam, leave Eve, they're over. We're done with them. You have Cain and Hevel. One of them is still working within Garden of Eden type of perspective, and the other one is dealing with post-sin perspective. Did that make any sense just now? One of them is a shepherd, and the other of them plants the ground. What did God say would be the sin, would be the ramification or the punishment that happens? You have to now work the ground. What did Adam do beforehand? He just gave names to all the animals. So therefore, the shift that took place was a shift of being, you know, I would call it shepherd-like, being with all the animals, taking but not having to work at all, versus having to work the ground. When I then look at Adam and at Cain and Abel, Cain and Hevel, and I look and I say, hold it a second. One is pre-sin perspective, and the other is post-sin perspective. Yes? Is that okay? Afterwards, okay, and let's just now just read that midrash back into this, that one of them is jealous, which goes back to who's the only one who we know is being jealous till this point? Nachash. So we have jealousy implanted in one, and the other one seems to be not involved at all. Now, what's scary about all that, about everything that I've just now said, is that Cain kills Hevel, which means the good one is gone, right? Hevel is gone. Hevel was the, which one? What did Hevel do for a living? Hevel is the shepherd. Hevel is gone. Cain lives on. But Adam and Eve have another child. According to Chazal, it seems to be 133 years later. Did you ever suspect that you may get into a fight with your spouse if you got evicted from the Garden of Eden because of what you perceive to be the other one? So according to Chazal, they didn't speak for 133 years. This caused a huge, huge fight. And then they get back to, by the way, if you live for 900 and whatever, 70 years, so 133-year fight is, I guess, normal. It's a lost weekend. And they have another child. Okay, and who's the other child? Okay, good. So now everything is set up. Cain is around, Hevel's dead, Shade is here. So where do we come from? You sure? Done? Easy. We're from. You're going to ruin everything. You're going to ruin everything now. So where do we come from? So do you remember? And this is another thing about Bereshit, and this is the whole Chumash generally, but specifically Bereshit. Do you remember there are really boring parts of the Chumash? And he begat he and begat he, and we just our eyes gloss over, and we sort of just like move on to the next. And you're all probably reading like some of the other things they put out in shul during that time. unless you're the rabbi, then you can't, and you have to make believe that you're still looking inside. If you actually follow through Bereshit Perek Dalet and Bereshit Perek Hey, you're going to come to this realization that Noach, just the genealogy over here, Noach comes from one line, from Shet, indeed. But apparently, and this is certainly true in terms of Chazal, that Noach's wife, whose name was Na'amah, comes from the other line. Which means Noach and Na'amah is this merger of the Shet and Cain line. Now that's a little scary. So what happens when the flood comes? The flood comes and wipes out all of the negative behavior. Now you think about all the negative behavior. What is it? What is the main part? And again, we have to be careful about this. Because we tend to learn things, our basic knowledge is what we learned in, if we're unfortunate enough to be religious from birth, that means we were indoctrinated as young people in yeshiva, what the Chumash says. And again, we start the problem at the beginning of Parshat Noach instead of looking at what it says at the end of Parashat Bereishit, because at the end of Bereishit it talks about, we can just call it, men behaving very badly, men taking whatever they want, powerful men taking any woman that they want. That's the whole background of the story, which means we find people behaving very nachash-like. And what does the flood come and do? The flood comes and wipes all that out, so therefore my visual of the flood is like a big mikvah, purifies everything, and we can start all over again, except we do have one problem. And our problem is post-flood. There must be a fancier way of saying that, right? Oh, cool. Very good. We have, as opposed to before the flood, which is a Bob Dylan, okay. So, after the flood, we have some behavior of one of the sons of Noah acting in a very poor way again, and I'm just pointing out that that negative behavior seems to be overflow of the negative behavior which had come from where? Which had come from where? Which had, okay, now we blame the mother, right? We always blame the mother. Which comes from the wife's family. All the negative behavior comes from the wife's family.
Can I quote you on that?
Yes. Especially to my wife's family. So all the negative behavior seems to be coming from that side. And here we have pre-flood, Nachash-like, Cain-like behavior somehow slipping through. And who's the one who holds on to this negative behavior? Knan, Cham, Knan. Now, here now will be a klal gadol. All negative behavior that happens post this in the Chumash is all connected to that one side of the family, in one way or the other. Most of it directly, genealogically. Think about the men who behave badly. Paro, Egypt, coming from? Do you need to hear that? Are you sure? Or? Uvnei Cham, Kush u'Mitzrayim futu Knan. Should that help there a little bit? In terms of who we're looking for? Ukush Yaladet Nimrod. Okay, are we on to something now? All negative behavior moving from this point on in the Chumash, whether it's going to be Paro, whether it's going to be Stone, whether it's going to be Avimelech, all the men trying to grab women along the way, all of them are coming from this one family. All of the negative behavior comes from there. Good? Again? No, that's not Avimelech. Malki Tzedek. Okay? So all the negative behavior you're going to find after the Bereshit, all coming from this one place. And now you see why we gave so much credit before to the Nachash, whoever he may be. Okay. So now let's move forward. We have Avraham, okay, a whole new thing. Where does Avraham come from? Which Okay, so that's good. Who does Avraham marry? Sarah, where does she come? Okay, every we're good. But along the way, Avraham has to have a, should we call it a dalliance? What should we call this?
Pelagish.
Not necessarily a pelagish. It's far more complicated. He has, okay, here's just the men listed right now. If your wives tell you to sleep with the help, do not do this. Okay? And you know what? If you even get it in writing, it's not going to help. Okay? Just a little advice to help you. So, Avraham has a relationship with Hagar. Where does she come from? Mitzrayim. Where does Mitzrayim come from? Okay, now you realize the complication with Yishmael? Yes? Because here we have, again, the two different sides, the Avram side, which is great. By the way, I'll tell you something which I think I'm allowed to say what I think is interesting. The whole story about Hagar, what does Chazal, Rashi even says it, what does Chazal tell us is the identity of Hagar? Who is she? She is a princess. She is Bat Paro. So why is that so interesting? So again, I don't want to ruin the next book for you, but in the next book, we're actually going to have a real Bat Paro come and be a whole part of the Geula, a part of the salvation. But now you realize that the Chumash and Chazal, especially, all the time, work in terms of topologies, in terms of different types of personalities, different types of people, and it works with what we can call a theory of conservation of characters, where it tries to make characters as similar as one to another, even identical with one another as possible. Therefore, Hagar becomes the Egyptian princess, and she's going to be the same as someone else who will be Egyptian princess called Bithya. What's going to be the big difference between the two? The big difference is that Bithya will therefore, she will raise Moshe, she will therefore leave her Egyptian identity and join the Jewish people, by the way, as it says black and white in Divrei HaYamim, that she ends up marrying into the Jewish people, leaving Egypt and joining us. Hagar can't seem to do that, and Hagar seems to have this problem, which Chazal then really explain much more and say that no, again, it comes back to that there's this jealousy in terms of Sarah, and she completely belittles Sarah, which is another important lesson, that Avram and Sarah are spiritual equals at least, perhaps even if anything, Sarah has an advantage. But what Hagar does not accept is the greatness of Sarah. But I'm going to say it again. It's not just Hagar. It's Hagar has Yishmael, and there is a lot of Egyptian. Matter of fact, when she leaves Avram, where does she go? She moves much more to... Where does she get a wife for Yishmael from? She brings him a wife from Mitzrayim again, which means that we have this earlier theme being played out as we continue. So now, let's move on now to our next generation. We end up having that Avram and Sarah have a child, okay, Mazel Tov, and the child, well, Avram and Sarah have a child, Yitzchak. So that's all very good. Now Yitzchak has to get married, so where do you have to find a wife from? It's not going to be from Canaan. It cannot be from Canaan. One second, are you a little bit more sensitive to that issue now? It cannot be from Canaan. It can't be from Egypt. It can't be from B'nai Cham. It can't be from that. So what do you need to do? You have to go back and find a wife from Shem. It has to be that kind of wife. So again, this is something we may not have noticed, or we've perhaps looked at it just as a small little issue, but it's obviously a lot bigger than we had noticed before. Fine. So Yitzchak and Rivka get married. Everything is wonderful. She gets pregnant after 20 years, and she's pregnant with two children. With twins. Actually, she may not know that. She gets pregnant, and she gets very, very concerned about this pregnancy, and she turns to God. And God, by the way, could have made this very easy on the family, and God could have said one thing: you're pregnant with twins. That's what's so unusual. That's it. That could have been enough. And God goes and ruins the entire story, because again, and says, oh, and by the way, the younger one is going to be successful, and the older one's going to be a loser, which God also read the book and knows exactly what all of Bereshit is about, and therefore that theme is going to be carrying through. And do you realize how bad this is? Because now what exactly does she do? Does she tell her husband, oh yeah, but listen, by the way, Asa is going to be a loser, or does she sort of just go on? At this point, she's in an impossible position. So she has these twins. Now, the big question over here is Yitzchak. He looks at these two kids, and one of them should remind him of somebody that he knows. And who's that? Yaakov should remind him of somebody. Yaakov says, Ishtam Yoshev Ohalim. Who should he remind him of? Okay, sometimes we don't see ourselves. Of his father, right? Avram Avinu sitting in a tent. There should be some kind of a recollection there. And he has another son. And who's the other son? The other son is Esav. And Esav is identified as a... as a hunter. Now, he should also remind him of somebody. And who's that? Nimrod. Ah, remember Nimrod? Where does Nimrod come from? So do you realize this genetic joke? Yitzchak has two children. One who reminds him of Avraham and one who reminds him of Nimrod. And by the way, this should be an absolute no-brainer as far as how we continue the story over here. Yeah, okay, just again, at the risk of ruining it, Yitzchak And despite everything that Rav Hirsch says, if you don't know what he says, then even better. Despite everything that Rav Hirsch says, there's no question in my mind that Yitzchak knows exactly what's going on, in the sense that one is like Avraham. Later on, when he is going to give the blessings, how does he divide the blessings? He wants to give Esav a blessing of spirituality, sorry, of physicality. He wants to try to take Esav, and as much as possible, to channel his hunting towards a mitzvah. I'm going to say it in the simplest way. If Yitzchak asks Esav, who's a hunter, to go hunt and bring me food, what did he just now do with the hunting? He just now turned it into a mitzvah of kivud ava'im. That's what Yitzchak tries to do. Yitzchak loves Esav because he's a hunter, or kitzayid b'fiv, whatever ki may mean in that. Ki is not always an easy word to translate. And he tries to channel Esav into bringing things and into somehow using his hunting in a positive way. We all realize that may not be a very simple thing to do. Yaakov, on the other hand, there's no question, at least in my mind, that there was no question in Yitzchak's mind, that the son who is like Avraham will get the bracha of Avraham. The easy way of doing this is follow the brachot. There are three brachot offered in Parshat Toldot. One bracha is the bracha Yitzchak wanted to give Esav, and he gave to Yaakov when he thought he was Esav. The second bracha is the one he gives to Esav when he knows that he's Esav. And the third bracha is the one that he gives to Yaakov when he knows that it's Yaakov. The one he gives to Yaakov when he knows it's Yaakov contains what?
And the land.
Which means Esav was going to get all kinds of great stuff. But what did we also do? Maybe you already forgot about the land. What is the important thing to keep your eye on? The land. Always keep your eye on the land. Who was supposed to get the land? Yaakov is supposed to get the land. And that already tells us everything that we need to know. What does Rivka decide? She decides that Yaakov doesn't only need the land, he also needs, wouldn't be so bad, right? It's Tevye. Okay, wouldn't be so bad, you know, if we would have some money also. This would, right? What's so bad if Jews would have some money? And by the way, God speaks to Yaakov subsequently? Yes. And God gives him brachot? Yes. What brachot does God give him as we move on? He gives him brachot of having children, gives brachot of having the land of Israel. What does he never tell him? That the brachot that he stole, he'll be getting. The brachot that Yaakov stole of God never comes back until here. By the way, I'm giving all that as well. Complete silence in terms of that. But in terms of the brachot that Yitzchak gave to Yaakov when he knew that it was Yaakov, immediately God confirms, yeah, you're getting that, that's yours. Land of Israel, that's Yaakov's. Which again should help focus us. And that leads us to the last part of the book of Bereshit. And I think we have everything in line now to really understand the book. There is one verse which I think is the most important verse towards the end, which, it's a verse that we completely ignore. Why do we ignore it? Because it's in one of the boring places. We get with he begat, 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 begat. But the verse says like this, because not only is it worse that it's begatting, but it's begatting in Esav's family, and who cares about Esav? And it says, Ve'elah ha-malachim ha-shamachu be'eretz Edom, which is completely uninteresting to us, except for the last part of the verse. What's the last part? Lefnei malach melech levnei Yisrael. Why is it talking about a melech levnei Yisrael? We don't have a melech. We're not going to have a melech for 100. When are we going to have a melech? By the way, who was the first person who became king? Who was the first? Forget about this. Who was the first person in the world who decided to rule over others? Who? Yeah, you wrote a cartoon about this. Excellent. Nimrod. Nimrod's the first one to then take. So now we're talking about the kingship within Edom, but before there's a king of Israel. So here's the topic for the rest of the book of Bereshit. Who's going to be king? Who's going to be? You say, what are you talking about? Who's going to be king? That's the topic moving forward now. Yaakov has a whole bunch of kids. One of them he favors. One of them he gives royal clothing. How do I know that it's royal clothing? How do I know that Ketonet Pasim is royal clothing? What's the only other time Ketonet Pasim is mentioned in Tanakh? Who it says is royal clothing. Right? It says he gives. You heard that from me, or you heard that? Okay, I'm just kidding. It's the only. It's okay. Rashi hints at it, and the Ramban says it. It's the only other time that we find Ketonet Pasim is used is when the children of David. And it says, and that's the royal clothing. Yaakov gives Yosef royal clothing. That's a hint. He seems to see Yosef as the man who will be king. What happens when Yosef has his dream? What do the brothers think? Total delusions of grandeur. What do they say to him? What are the words? Hamaloch timloch aleinu. Okay, I'm going to say it again. And what's the topic? who's going to be king? And what are they saying? No way in the world are you going to be king. Now, were they right or are they wrong? Well, are you going to rule over us? Again, what's the answer? Yes, yes. Both, by the way, both. He'll be a Moshel, he'll be a king, but they don't seem to appreciate this. And that, as I said, leads us to the last part of the book. Now, just to realize how bad all of this is, we have to now channel everything else that we have. What do we need to keep an eye on? Well, we need to keep an eye on everything. So, tell me the first dream. The first dream that Yosef has. What's it about? Second dream. First dream that Yosef has is? Right? And their sheaves will bow down to his sheaves. By the way, will that happen? Yes, yes. They will come to him to get food. They will come and bow down to him in order to get food. Now, Rav Soloveitchik has, this is important now. It's like the only thing that he wrote which everybody can read. Like, it's, why is that funny? It was originally called the Fear Drashot. Later on, today in English they called it the Rav Speaks. It was called the Chamesh Drashot in Hebrew because the four became five. Don't worry, it was a mistranslation. They just found another one and they threw it in. And it was the talks that Rav Soloveitchik gave to the Mizrahi. I remember when they had a shloshim for the Rav in Yerushalayim and they brought all of the Haredi family and whatever came. Not all family, but one person who did come, Rav Yechiel Michal Feinstein came, if you don't know who that is. That was very interesting that he came. Yes, you know who it is? Rav Moshe Feinstein's nephew, who is son-in-law of the Brisker Rav, who, when Rav Soloveitchik opened up a yeshiva in Boston, which was called Heichal Rav Chaim Halevi. He opened the yeshiva in a kollel. This was long before Maimonides was there. And then his father passed away and he went to New York. But it was called Yeshiva Heichal Rav Chaim Halevi. And Rav Yechiel Michal Feinstein was his co-Rosh Yeshiva or Rosh Kollel. And the two of them ran this yeshiva together. As I said, he then came to Eretz Yisrael and became absolutely part of this real Haredi world. The Boston Rebbe was there, the previous one passed away, and he spoke. And he goes, the Rav told me that every single talk that he gave by the Mizrahi, he could have given the same talks by the Aguda. And I think I was the only one who chuckled when he said this because I actually read them. And that is absolutely preposterous. Because when you read the first one, Yosef Echav, what is the whole point of it? The whole point of the drasha is that you have all of the brothers who he called, the great Hasidic Rebbes and the great Rosh Yeshivas, and then you had Yosef. Now, listen to what the Rav said because it is so sharp. And it's not just a drasha, it is so sharp in terms of understanding what went on there. What was the dream about? The dream was about sheaves. What do the brothers do for a living? Shepherds. The brothers are shepherds. One second. Do you realize now that we have our same tension again? At this point, the Rav didn't make in terms of the Cain v'Hevel issue, but it's the same tension again. What the Rav did say is that the brothers were shepherds. We were shepherds, so we'll always be shepherds. We live in Europe, we'll always live in Europe. And Yosef has a dream of a new reality. And the new reality is that we're going to become farmers. And they say that's preposterous. We're shepherds. We'll always be shepherds. And what the Rav said is that all the great Gedolim saw the future through the lens of the past. And Yosef HaTzadik is the only one who sees the future through a lens of the future. And he goes, who is right? He goes, HaKadosh Baruch Hu paskin like Yosef. And essentially, this talk was a talk absolutely designed to counter Das Torah. That all the Gedolim can say one thing, and God disagrees with all the Gedolim, and God agrees with the religious Zionists. That the Boston Rebbe can say that the Rav could have given the same speech by the Aguda is just like, I don't have any words to say. I won't say anything else about this, but I do encourage you to actually read it, and then, you know, not just to see if you agree with the Boston Rebbe or not, but read it because it really is important. These talks are really important, and they're just as important today. Even though every now and then there'll be references about things that happened long, long ago, you'll find the talks interesting. But I do want to take that one point that he made. Because when I saw this, I say, wow, look at this, Cain and Hevel. Cain and Hevel, right here. Now, let's go a little bit deeper into this point. The brothers are shepherds. Why are they shepherds? What are shepherds? Shepherds are nomads. They go from one place, they move to the other place, and wherever they can find places, That's where they graze. But what does it mean to be a farmer? It's your land. This is where you live. This is yours. Yosef sees a time. This will be ours. And the brothers just know we're wandering from place to place. That is such an interesting distinction. But now if you go a little bit further, you realize if the brothers have any kind of sensitivity towards biblical history, Yosef is talking about being a farmer, and they're talking about being shepherds. Therefore, they see Yosef as being like Cain. Well, they're all like Hevel. And now you realize how dangerous Yosef is. And the scene where Yosef comes through the field, it's almost an exact scene of Cain and Hevel going out into the field. But what happens then? Cain rises up and kills Hevel in the field. And now Yosef comes in the field, and the brothers can be, again, I'm certainly reading into it, and possibly in a way you've never considered, that the brothers are looking at Yosef as being dangerous, as being Cain-like. And last time Cain got us in the field, he killed us. And the brothers therefore want to take a preemptive strike because they see Yosef as being like Cain in terms of his whole fetish, in terms of we're going to be farmers. Jews being farmers, what a ridiculous thing that is, you know. Everyone knows we're shepherds. So now, moving with this a little bit further, they end up, first kill him, then, what was the second choice? First to kill him, the second choice was Reuven, no, second choice, first choice was kill him actively, the second choice was Reuven, I know what he's thinking, but the second choice is let's throw him in the pit and let him die of natural causes. The third choice was, let's sell him. By the way, do you notice what happens? They're all sitting down to eat. This is unbelievable. They're all sitting down to eat, and what happens? We read the pasuk kaf hey. V'yeshvu l'chol lechem, which by the way to me is also completely preposterous. Your brother is screaming from the pit, as we learn later on. He's screaming from the pit, and they're sitting down. Can you pass the hummus and whatever? And they're, you know, they're having a meal, which by the way I think is one of the reasons why before we leave Egypt, we need to sit together and have a meal as a family. Which is actually why Pesach also, we invite the members of the family we don't like, right? And we have to be together as one. I'm Avin Yavin. Excuse me? Yes. So they sit down to have their meal. V'yeshvu le'echol lechem. V'yisu einehem. They lift up their eyes. And they see Yishma'elim coming by from Gilad. Now you're watching this, you're eating. What are you thinking to yourselves? It is a sign from God. It is a sign from God. God is telling us what to do. We don't have to kill him. Who are you, who is Yishma'el? Yishma'el is the one who Sarah Imenu insisted on kicking them out of the house. Sarah is sending up a sign what we should do. What happens right then? It continues and says, Yehuda says, why should we kill him and cover up his blood? L'chud v'nkrali Yishma'elim, let us sell him to Yisrael, right? And right then it says, v'yu Yisrael anashim midyanim socharim. Okay, that's a little harder. Who is Midyan? Who's Midyan's father? Bum, bum. Anyone want to call a friend? Who's Midyan's father? Such silence. It's unbelievable. I know modesty is impressive. Midyan's father is somebody, you know him. His name is Avraham. This is one of the B'nai Keturah. You can look it up. It really says it. Which means, do you realize as the brothers are watching this? Yishmael, Midyan, rejected brother, not even considered brothers. Midyan's not even a brother. But do you remember what the Pasuk says, that what happened to Midyan? They were all sent away, while Yitzhak remains the real. This is a sign from God. By the way, this is part of the problem of us seeing signs from God, especially when you don't like your brother. Send them away. This is what God wants. And where do they send him? They send him with the Yishmaelim, which is so beautiful. And where are they heading towards? Egypt. This is perfect. Because that's where Yosef belongs. Now, I do want to pause for a second. We said 45 minutes? We're over.
It's okay.
You know what I get for overtime? Okay. So what's interesting is Yosef goes and meets Egypt. Yosef meets Egypt. What's Egypt represent? Egypt is Cham. Egypt is the Nachash. Egypt is all the negativity. They're rolled into one. And he meets up with Eshet Potiphar. right? Here's to you, Mrs. Potiphar, right? He meets Mrs. Potiphar, and what does the Esther say? Are you trying to seduce me, Mrs. Potiphar, right? Okay, only he gets it. Anyway, Yosef runs away from this. Yosef withstands that temptation. And we all know, we can have every single reason in the world to justify, and especially previous chapter, and you can, I know I shouldn't say this, and I apologize for saying this. Yehuda's hooking up with a hooker. Okay, I'm sorry I said it. Is it true?
Yes.
But it's okay. Because she wasn't really a hooker. It was really his daughter-in-law, which is much better. So, and Yosef...
She took the money.
Actually, she didn't. She took the down payment. She took the down payment. Anyway, the collateral. So, try to stay over here, okay? So you realize now, and Yehuda is together with the Canaanites, with the local people. He marries into them. His children marry into them, which now you realize, hold it, something over there is wrong. And Yosef, who's going to be accused of every poor thing in the world, and Yosef withstands. He's 17 years old. And I mean, today we wanted to, you say, raging hormones and good business opportunity, and you get a good job in the house there instead of having to work who knows what. He gets to work who knows what. And Yosef withstands that temptation. And the brothers, by the way, don't understand it. They don't believe it. Which leads me to one of the saddest verses in the entire book. What verse is that? When Yosef meets up with his brothers after all these years, he knows they're coming. Yosef always knew they're coming. Yosef always knew they're going to bow down to him. And then one day he gets pulled into Paro's palace. Egypt, corrupt, indecent. And he hears the dreams. 7 years, another 7 years. And he understands what it's going to be. And realize the right answer for Yosef to have given, to interpret those dreams, should have been, again, we don't get it, but the right answer that he should have given to Paro was, you're going to make a lot of money in 7 years, put it all aside, all the other nations around you are going to have no money whatsoever, go to war and capture the entire region. That is the response to tell a pagan. Instead, he gives a Jewish response. What is the Jewish response? We're going retail. We're opening up stores. We're going to be making a lot of money right now. And I'm saying, think about it. It's an unbelievable response that Yosef gives. The most impressive part is that he convinces Paro to go into business. We're going to business. Yosef is saying, I'm going to make you a lot of money. You're going to become a very, very rich man right now. And he pulls him into it. But realize that to sell food to people who could be your enemies, to sell them food, is something which perhaps they never even considered, never even thought of. And Yosef over here is, no, we're going to make money and we're going to sell food to people. It's a very ethical way. This is the same Egyptians that Sari Imenu shows up there and they're grabbing her into the bedroom, taking things that aren't theirs. These are people who don't mind taking things which aren't theirs. And Yosef is slowly teaching ethical monotheism to Paro. I'm saying that's amazing. Yosef knows the brothers are coming. He knows they don't have food. He knows they're going to come. And they finally show up in the house. And I'm saying this is the scene which I think is so sad. And there's a couple things going on in his head. One thing is my father still alive? Second thing is, did they kill my brother? 1 second, do you realize how this can haunt him and gnaw at him? What has happened to my brother? Did they do to him like they did to me? Is my father alive? Could he be alive? What's going on? And the third thing is, do they recognize him? And they walk in the room, and they bow down. And as they're getting up slowly, I'm saying this is the scene. And as they're getting up slowly, Yosef does not know one thing. Do they recognize him? And they get up, because if they do recognize him, what do they... Okay, let's try it this way. When they get up, they all see it's Yosef. So now what do they do? What do they say? Don't say exactly what they say. But what do they say? Oh my, right? It's Yosef. It's Yosef. What do you say now when you realize it's Yosef? What? We are very, very sorry. We may have made a mistake, right? We made a strategic error a couple of years ago. Like, the dreams are true. The dreams are true. They're bowing down trying to get his food. I mean, it's exactly what he had said. But you realize what happens? They don't recognize him. That's the point, which is so sad. By the way, had they recognized him, anybody want to write a speech that they should have said? If they did recognize him, what should they say? I'm sorry for belaboring this point. What should they say? They should say, we're really sorry. You were right about everything. And please give us food because Dad is back in Canaan and he really needs food and he's starving. That's why we came here. So bring us food. We accept that you were right in everything that you've said and we're sorry for what we did. We need to bring food to Dad. Which he could have come back and said, sure. Like, after I put you all in prison, I'll send food for him. I'll take care of him. But again, it could have played out in all kinds of ways. Or, by the way, Yosef could have been, as he always really was, and we know this, he could have been very majestic and say, I forgive you, and taken care of them, which he ends up doing. But that's not what happened. What does Yosef say instead to them? He goes, No. What does Yosef say to them? He says to them, where have you come from? What is the right answer to that question? Canaan. What answer do they give? They give the wrong answer. They say, we came from Canaan to get food. Wrong answer. You're on a food line. Of course you came to get food. Once you start saying, oh, we came to get food. Oh, really? Like, why did you have to explain that? At that point, Yosef responds, and he's very upset. Why is he upset? Because they don't recognize him. Why is he upset? It just now said why he's upset. Because he recognizes them, and they don't recognize him. And he remembers the dreams. One second, you hear the Torah screaming right now? Why is it screaming that? Why is it saying that? Because who doesn't remember? They don't remember the dreams, they don't remember him, they don't recognize him, nothing. What does he say to them? He says, you guys are spies. And what do they say? You came to look in the seedy parts of town. I'm deliberately translating it that way. And they say, no. We just came to get food. We're all sons of one man. By the way, we're not slaves. Just because you're sons. What, James Bond doesn't have a brother? Right? Just because we're brothers doesn't mean we're spies? What does one thing have to do with the other? And he says, no. You came to look be'erva ta'aretz. And they say, no. We're 12 sons of one man. Shneim asar avadecha achim anachnu bnei ish achad. By the way, his father's alive, his brother's alive. Do you realize how nice that is? It flows, it rings. And what does Yosef respond to that? He's the one I'm talking about when I said that you're spies. What's he talking about? There's a beautiful midrash which is focused on this Erevat Haaretz. The midrash says that when the brothers came, Yosef informed passport control and said, take the names of everybody who comes in. And when Reuven ben Yaakov and so on comes in, let me know. He gets a message finally, his brothers came in. And he goes, okay, shut all the stores and only have one store open. When they show up for that store for food, call me. 3 days go by, it says they don't show up. It then says that Yosef sends 70 soldiers to search through all of, say, where are they? Where are they? And they find them in the red light district. Now, of course, you can say, Yosef's brother's going to hookers. That never happened, right? Well, it says, stop. But you know what it says? It says they say to one another, let's look for Yosef. Now, Yosef's a loser. He was good looking. But he was a loser. If Yosef is doing anything, he's working as a male prostitute. And says they're looking for him in the seedy parts of town. And Yosef says to them, that's what this midrash is telling. It's based on these words. Yosef says, Meraglim with him, you're looking for something. What does he want them to say? He goes, no, we want food. You're looking, no, you're looking for something. No, we want food. No, you're looking for something. And they say, no, we're 12 sons of one man. One is with their father. What does Yosef say? He's the one I'm talking about. You're looking for him. Yosef is begging them to say, we're looking for Yosef. If they would have said the following speech, again, this is another speech that never happens. A long time ago, we got into a fight with our brother. We haven't seen him in many years. We have reason to believe in Egypt. We want to make up with him. We want to bring him back home. And we want to reunite him with his father. What would Yosef have said to that speech? He would have said, I need Yosef. That would have been the end right there. Okay, let's skip everything when they finally make up, and then we'll have to get to the end of this because Maspikvar. Nachon? Nachon. When they finally make up, and they finally, Yehuda goes and gives the speech of his life, and he says, you know, you've been after us, and you've been picking on us, and we're honorable people. Realize how Yosef is trying not to laugh right now? We're honorable people, and we're good people, and we're decent people. And you're breaking our father's heart. You're taking away the son from him that he loves. And if you take away the son from him that he loves, that he's going to die. He just can't live like this. And what are these terrible things that you're doing? Finally, Yehuda goes one step further, and he says the important thing he needs to say. And he says, listen, my father loves this son. Let me take his place. By the way, if Yehuda was really sharp, he could have, at the very beginning, before all this happened, he could have said, yeah, it was my goblet, I put it in his bag. It's mine. That's it. By the way, that would have been the end of the whole thing. It was mine. But when you're nervous, you say all kinds of things, and they're nervous, and they are nervous, and they don't know what to say. And finally, Yehuda blurts this out and says, let me be the slave, and let Binyam goes back to his father. Again, and his reasoning is very clear. And what's his reasoning? His reasoning is because his father loves him, and if you take away the son that he loves, he's going to die. So what's Yosef's response? Ani Yosef, Ahura Bichai. Do you realize how cynical that is? Ani Yosef, you just said. You just said, if you take away the son from it that he loves, he's going to die. Ani Yosef, Ahura Bichai. And that's it. There's nothing more for the brothers to say at that point. It's over. Now, what does Yosef say and what do they hear? Yosef goes on to say, God did this, and God was involved in this, and God's plan was this, and God saved us, and so on and so forth. And you know what the brothers heard him say? You're not going to believe me now. But I'll just prove this, and then we'll wrap it up. What the brothers heard him say was, oh, my father's still alive, I can't kill you yet. How do I know that's pshat? Because the brothers tell us later it's pshat. Which means the brothers hear, again, they thought he was Kayin beforehand, now they hear him as if he's Esav. What does Esav say? I'll wait for my father to die and then I'll kill him. And that's what they hear him say. And what happens at the end of Vayichi? Yaakov dies and the brothers come over and say, you know, basically, don't kill us, we'll be slaves. They never trust him. They think he's like Cain, they think he's like Esav, they think he's like every evil thing in the world, except we know the truth. He's Yosef HaTzadik. So now this is a happy book or is this a sad book? First of all, notice something. Yaakov knows that Yosef is the tzaddik, and Yaakov knows that, what does he give him? Two portions of the land. Follow the land, follow the blessing. Yosef also gets a blessing of many, many children. Do you notice it? The bracha of children and the bracha of land both go over to Yosef. Yaakov's main brachot, which were Yitzchak's main brachot, which were Avraham's main brachot, all go over directly to Yosef. Not only that, Yosef doesn't only get a double portion, he ends up with a triple portion of land. How so? Better? So Yosef ends, Yosef ends up getting the double portion, so you have rejected firstborn. One rejected firstborn is Reuven. So what does Reuven say? Okay, I'm not getting a double portion, I don't want any portion. Who's another rejected firstborn? God. I'm not getting a double first, I don't want any part. Reuven and God, they're both firstborn, who are staying outside the land. Menashe, who is also a firstborn, who was never involved in that discussion in the beginning, gets sent over. Menashe gets the land in Israel, and, right, Ephraim gets his part, Menashe gets his part, and Menashe also gets all of the Golan. Right? If you take a look at what Menashe, it's huge, the amount of Menashe gets. Yosef ends up getting, between the three, Yosef ends up getting, I'm not going to say exactly, I think it's around 40%, of the land of all the tribes, maybe even closer to 50%, of all the lands ends up going to Yosef. So follow the land, it's Yosef. The brothers for that part, now what's the difference then? What's the difference from the beginning of the book to the end of the book? When Cain kills Hevel, what does God say? Sorry, what God says, okay, where's Hevel? And what does Cain answer? Hashomer achi anochi? What's Yosef's response to that? I am my brother's keeper. And Yosef ends up, and that's the difference between the beginning of the book and the end of the book. In the beginning, and the whole book is brothers who don't get along. In the beginning, it starts with one brother kills the other brother out of jealousy. The brothers are jealous. And by the way, there's an unbelievable Medrash Tanchum that says that everything that happens to Yosef is a metaphor. It happened, but it's a metaphor for the land of Israel. Yosef and Tzion are the same in Gematria, and everything that happens to Yosef ends up happening to Tzion, and the Midrash goes through step after step after step in terms of what happens to Israel, Tzion, Zion, in terms of Yosef. Because Yosef is Tzion. Yosef does get the land. Yosef is the one who gets the blessing. But what's the difference of the end of the book versus the beginning of the book? Yosef will not allow this family to be broken up. And it would have been so easy to take revenge. It would have been so easy for him to kill them. It would have been so easy to do all kinds, to send them away. They try to get rid of him. He comes back in their lives. And what does he do? He gives them food and he gives them, right? He gives them clothing and he takes care of them, gives them jobs and takes care of them for the next 70 years or so. The next time you do have an annoying relative who stays 70 years, he takes care of his family and he makes sure that the end of the book is not the same as the beginning of the book. Which means, let's wrap it all up. What is the book of Bereishit about? It's about the land of Israel. Keep your eye on the land. What is it about? Well, there's this jealousy which comes from the very beginning, from the serpent, and flows all the way through the story. There are these bad guys who keep getting punished, and that's when God gets involved. When God does speak, what does he speak about? Inevitably, he speaks about the land. Who's the one, last third of the book, who's the one who will be king? So now we have a challenge. Will it be Yosef or will it be Yehuda? And the answer, by the way, is both. That's the answer at the very end. It really will be both. For the messianic prophecies to take place, we need the two of them to join together in Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David. That's a whole other talk. But that's where things end up afterwards. Who will be king? That's the whole last third of the book. The brothers look at Yosef, who is the most competent person in Tanakh. And what do they see? They see Cain and they see Esav and they see every single evil there. And they're ready to get rid of him, and they see signs of God saying to get rid of him. And they get rid of him. But Yosef comes right back in their life, and everything that he sees comes true. And Yosef withstands temptation when none of them can withstand temptation. Yosef is the one who makes sure the family stays together. Which means as much as it looks like, what a sad ending, what a sad book this is. No. This is real life, and this is family, and we don't always get along. But Yosef makes sure they stay together. And once we stay together, then we'll be able to leave Egypt as one family as well. We're going to end the book of Bereishit looking at the land, looking at God. There will be cataclysms. Egypt better watch out because it's coming, but that's the next book.